What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. Our Resistance in Residence artist this week is actor, comedian, playwright, radio host, journalist, so many things, Brian Copeland. So I want to start with a little bit about you, where and how you grew up. What was your family like?
I was born in Akron, Ohio. We left when I was five. My father was at Fort Hood in Texas. We moved to Texas. We were there about 6 or 8 months, and my mom and dad split up, and then my mom wanted to come to California. So we ended up in the Bay Area, and we bounced around for a bit. You know, we were in Berkeley for a while, then we were in East Oakland, then we were in Hayward, and then we settled in San Leandro, which was a pivotal point in my life. When we moved here in 1972, it was, depending on whose numbers you believe, between 94 and 99.9% white. And my mother got us in. It was nationally known as a racist enclave. Housing discrimination, redlining. They wouldn't even show places to people of color. But my mother, for some reason, wanted to live in San Leandro. So she, you know, got a white girlfriend, her best friend, to go in and get the apartment application. My mother filled it out. Her friend turned it back in. And we moved in, and all hell broke loose. And what that ended up becoming, the story of how I ended up growing up in San Leandro after my mother died. My grandmother raised me and my four sisters by herself. Ended up becoming my first one-man show, Not a Genuine Black Man, which opened at the Marsh in 2004 and went on to become the longest-running solo play in San Francisco theatrical history. Went off Broadway, 30 different cities, a book that was a bestseller that's required in a number of schools. It deals with racial identity and what it's like to not fit in. So it's a long story. And, you know, for me to go into detail here, you don't have enough time. but that was my childhood. Is the only black face in the room.
I know my listeners, so I'm going to ask one follow-up question, and then we will move on. You said all hell broke loose. What did that look like, and how did it impact you as a young black child?
Oh, it impacted me horribly. I mean, up to the point to where I had PTSD from the situation as an adult. I had PTSD from it, and ended up with having a breakdown when I was 36 with all that stuff I never dealt with. You know, when a sale of hell broke loose, you know, the owner of the apartment complex was furious when he found out that they had rented to blacks. And this harassment campaign began, you know, where my mother was getting phone calls at work and people calling her the N-word, anonymous phone calls. We had a sewer pipe burst under our apartment unit, and it reeked like garbage for days. Nobody else's, just ours. Our front door knob kept being bashed in like with a crowbar, and we call the police, and they go, "Oh, looks like these are burglars trying to get in here. Maybe you might be more comfortable someplace else." And finally, they evicted us. They gave us an eviction notice saying that that our family of six, at the time we were six, was too many people for a 3-bedroom apartment. And, you know, fair housing, now that fair housing is one of the places where the one of the constituencies of the show, did a lot of fair housing events, you know, said how illegal that is. So my mother sued. You know, my mother, single mother of at the time 4 children, sued this wealthy white landowner in the East Bay. And I don't want to give away what happened, because that's it's a pivotal plot point in the book or the play, if anybody ever decides they want to see it. You know, all of that, you know, walking to school, as a little boy, with grown ass people driving by and yelling the N-word out the car window at me, being followed from aisle to aisle in the store, having a mob on our front porch claiming that I did something that I didn't do because they said the black kid did it and I'm the only one. You know, I'm the only one around, so therefore it must be me. I mean, that was my childhood. So that's all hell breaking loose. That's just a part of it. I mean, I got a million stories I'm going to do the 20th anniversary of the book, Not a Genuine Black Man. We're going to do a second edition next, that'll come out next year. And I've got more stories, things that I've forgotten about that I'm going to add to that. And if anybody wants to see the play, I'll be doing the play in September. I bring it back periodically. I've done six solo shows after Genuine, and I still bring Genuine out for special occasions. Like we had the 1,000th show last year, the 1,000th performance. I brought it back for that, and I'm going to do a special one at the Douglas Morrison Theater in Castro Valley. It's in September. I'm not sure what the date is, but if you go to their website, I'm sure it's there, and I know the tickets are available. But classes have been assigned to see this show. As I said, it's the book is used in schools. Silicon Valley Reads chose it as the book that all of Santa Clara County read at the same time. So people get a lot from it. And I'm thinking about starting a project. I'm very seriously thinking about starting a project like in the next month to raise funds to take this show to a half a dozen high schools and colleges in the Bay Area next spring. And make it free to the community. And the thought being that it's a way to talk about, here's what happens when you don't have diversity. Here's why diversity, equity, and inclusion are important, because this is what happens when you don't have it. This is what happens to the mindset of people. So anyway, that's the story.
All right. I'm gonna pay attention when that's back up. My partner was black man adopted into a white family in Berkeley. Similar, not exact, but similar stories. Brian Copeland, you do a lot of things. Wondering when you discovered storytelling, the theater, performance, writing, et cetera.
When I was 10 years old, I was 10 years old, and the eighth grade teacher at the Catholic school that I went to when I was in fifth grade, I started there, and it was awful. Same kind of thing, bullied, and when you go to a Catholic school, it's not like going to a public school. When you go to a public school, there's a lot of it's people move in and out a lot, and you have a lot of new kids and people leave and whatnot. Whereas in a parochial school. At least when I was growing up, it was pretty static. Everybody stayed. These were all families that had this during the kids were all born in the 60s when they used Vatican roulette, as they called it, for birth control. It didn't work, so all these people had 9, 10 kids, and all these kids grew up together, and so they'd known each other since birth. And then here I come. And so I had horrible self-esteem, and the eighth grade teacher put me in a play. She put me in Oliver, and I got to sing and I got to dance and I loved it. And she would do two plays a year of just a regular play and then a musical. And by the time I was in seventh grade, I was getting leads, and that's how I fell in love with the stage. And it gave me my self-esteem. It gave me my self-esteem. Was performing, and I just fell in love with it. And that teacher to this day is in, she's 80 years old, and she comes to every opening of every show that I do. And it's just, she saved me, quite frankly. If it hadn't been for the stage, I don't know what would happen to me. She saved me.
Yeah, that's a common story among storytellers as artists, right? Particularly, I find with the theater that the theater becomes a refuge and a place that saves our lives. Brian, Genuine Black Man, you talked about. We're going to get into the waiting period in a minute. As I was, looking at the shows you've done, they all seem to have a political or social message. And I'm wondering what role you believe theater plays, storytelling plays in changing, impacting the social fabric of our society.
Oh, I mean, everything I do has a point. I mean, from my plays, I want them to be about something. It's important for me that everything that I do is about something. Last year, I published my first crime novel. It's called Outraged, and my protagonist is an African American journalist who lives in African American investigative journalist for TV who works in San Francisco and lives in Castro Valley. And his sister, who's SFPD homicide, who also lives in Castro Valley. And what outrage this about is somebody is killing police officers who have killed unarmed people of color and not been punished. It was found to be justified, as it nor as it usually is in some way. So they're investigating to find out who did it. But that gave me an opportunity to, say some expound about what about the issue of unarmed people of color being killed by police officers. Second novel, second Topher, da his name is Topher Davis. The second Topher Davis novel came out last April. It is called Shadows of Justice, and Shadows of Justice is about an upper middle class what pregnant white woman in Pleasanton who goes missing, and it turns into Lacey Peterson with news cameras and reporters from all over the world covering it. Meanwhile, there is a young African American woman who is approximately the same age, who lives in East Oakland, who's pregnant, who disappears, and her mother can't get the police to do anything. She will can't get the media to do anything. So I'm able to use that. The whole point of that is to talk about the disparity in police and media coverage when it comes to a missing person of color, especially a missing woman of color. So all of my work is I when I decided I wanted to do the series, I wanted it to be about something. Not that, I mean, the mystery's there, and I don't preach. That's the whole thing. I never preach. But the role that storytelling plays, if you do it right, and I don't know if I do it right or not. I've been very fortunate in that critics have all pretty much all of my work have been very enthusiastic. So I guess I'm doing something right. But the idea is, you have to have this. People want to be entertained. They don't want to be lectured to. And it's real easy to go off on a diatribe about some of the stuff, especially if you're passionate about it. And if I'm not passionate about it, then I won't do it. So, but the role it plays is that storytelling plays is it allows you to deal with these issues in a way that is palatable for people who have difficulty discussing these things or have an aversion to discussing these things. My stand-up, I spent 20 years doing stand-up, opening for, Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin and Dionne Warwick and toured with Smokey Robinson and all of these folks. My work was, but it was funny, but it was all social commentary. And see, the entertainment is the spoonful of sugar. The entertainment is the spoonful of sugar. And so that as long as you can entertain them, they'll hear what it is that you're trying to say. A lecture, they'll zone out. But if they're being entertained, with a story or with jokes or, there's a, use the three act structure, to which is what I use pretty much to construct everything that it is that I do. They're along for the ride, and while they're along for the ride, they learn that when people of color send in a job application and it's a white person going through the application, if the name looks ethnic, they either conscious bias or unconscious bias, it's not given the same consideration as a name that sounds white. That's real, but that's something I'm able to put in, and and that is relevant to the story that I'm telling in Outraged. So it's the spoonful of sugar that makes that medicine go down, as the song goes.
I want to tug on the side just a little bit more, and we are living in, I mean, you've known me for a while. I'm a fairly cynical person, as you know.
Fairly,
And
fairly. Are you kidding? Set fairly. Hang on, let me look up my dictionary. Cynical. Oh, there's Cat's face.
this cat's face.
There's Cat's picture.
This guy's it. So, I've always had a particular viewpoint about America and race relations, et cetera. But even for me, right, even for someone like me, the times that we're living in right now are,
That's exactly what it's funny when people ask me about the times we're living in right now. I get exactly the same response that you just did. They're difficult to describe because this is supposedly the crap that America fought against and fought a whole world war, against. And now, we are becoming exactly what it is that we have fought against. We are becoming, an authoritarian society, thanks to one con man and a thousand or thousands or millions of enablers. That's where it is that we stand. That's one of the shows that I'm doing right now, my most recent show. It's called The Great American SHI blank. Show. S-S-H asterisk T show. And I do it once a month at a different place, and it's monologues on life. I do a series of four monologues with on four different topics that relate to life under the Trump regime, life in the Trump era. Because what's interesting is my audience is for it a full. They always sell out, and the critics are saying that it's a therapy session for progressives who've been quietly going crazy. That and that's it. It's a therapy session for progressives who've been quietly going crazy because that's all we get. Well, it's not all we can do. That's the thing. And like I partnered with Indivisible and some other, Swing Left and some other organizations. And I have somebody come up before I do the show and they'll introduce me, but beforehand they'll talk about what they've got coming up and how I let them have a table out front with their literature and to tell people how they can get involved and what it is that they can do. What it is that they can do that you don't just have to sit on your hands. There are a lot you can phone bank, you can, and you can call, people in swing districts around the country and try to educate them as to why, they need to really be careful about who it is they're voting for. There are lots of things that you could do and things I hadn't thought about that you can do. So,
Yes, we say don't agonize, organize, right? So
Oh, I
folks are
like that.
really,
I like that.
yeah, don't agonize, organize. There's so much to do, and including make art. And I wanted to hear your take on it because I actually think the role of artists right now is really crucial. And one of the, I mean, I've always had this conversation with folks, but like there is no movement, there is no revolution, there is no whatever folks are calling it without art and artists. There just isn't, never has been, never will be.
I mean, why do you think that he's attacked the arts the way that he has? Why do you think he took over the Kennedy Center and cut the National Endowment for the arts and government grants that have been clawed back that have already been awarded to theater companies because of the fact that theater and art can have a devastating effect. As far as the as oppressors are concerned. Why do you think Stephen Colbert got canceled? Anything they say about Colbert being canceled for financial reasons is nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. They, this was the number or is the number one talk show in late night. And if that show's losing money, what you do is you ask him to take a pay cut, you cut staff. You move out of the Ed Sullivan Theater that you're renting into a theater that CBS owns to save all that money. There's a lot of cost cutting they could do to make that show profitable if they wanted to. You don't just go, oh well, and roll over. This is about, it's about pre-acquiescence, I would call it. And it's a chilling effect because has a chilling effect because every other late show host, talk show host now has to worry about whether or not they are going to say something that angers Trump and the administration so that they do something to punish the parent company of the network that's running the show. So it's better just to do safe nonsense. So it's chilling. It really, really is chilling. We can't allow this to stand.
Brian Copeland, I want to move on to the waiting period, which is at the Marsh. Talk to us about the waiting period. What's it about and what inspired you to write it?
I suffer from depression. I mentioned earlier that when I was I guess it was 19, it was in 1999 that I had well, what was later described to me by mental health professionals as a breakdown, that was due to part. It was PTSD that was due to all of the crap that I went through and all the racial stuff that I went through as a child and never dealt with, all the things that I suppressed and never dealt with, and so they also diagnosed me with depression, which made a lot of sense. I mean, I'd suffered from it since I was a kid and didn't realize that that's what it was. So in 2008, I had a horrible, horrible life-altering experience. I had within a period of a couple of months, my grandmother, who raised me, who I love dearly, had a stroke and passed away suddenly. I had a marriage breakup, and it was, again, it was suddenly and surprising and unexpected. I got into a car accident where I totaled my car and injured my spine and needed spinal cord surgery. They weren't sure how much of my mobility I was going to get back after they did the spinal cord surgery, but the recovery was 3 months in a neck brace popping Vicodin. And I was severely depressed, and I decided I wanted to end it. So I went to a gun shop and I bought a 32 caliber Beretta Tomcat with the idea of getting it to end my life. And the problem was that in the state of California, there's a 10-day waiting period before you can get your hands on a handgun. And over that 10-day waiting period, I eventually came to my senses, because when you're in a fit of deep depression, a deep depressive bout, you're not in your right mind. You're just not. And it's like, well, like I say in the play, it's like there's this voice whispering in your ear that's trying to kill you. That's really the best way to describe it. And your brain is lying to you and telling you that this is the best way to end the pain. So I came to my senses. I wasn't completely out of the bout, obviously, but at least I didn't want to do that about 6 days in. So flash forward to 2011, and the nephew of a dear friend of mine was 15 years old, same age as my youngest boy was at the time. And this young man who I never met, his name's Colton Fink. I'll say his name because he was the reason for the show. Colton Fink had depression issues and had mental health issues. And this 15-year-old kid laid down in front of a moving train in Oakley. And that made me think, I'm going to tell my story, because depression is the last stigmatized disease. People are looking, just look at you differently if they know that you have depression. And so people hide it. People are embarrassed of it. And I thought, that's ridiculous. You wouldn't be embarrassed if you had cancer. You wouldn't be embarrassed if you had Lou Gehrig's disease or muscular dystrophy or anything else. So why do we do this when it comes to mental health? Why do we do this when it comes to to depression, which can be deadly? Depression and suicidal ideation that can end up being deadly. So I did the show. I didn't know how it was going to be received. And the waiting period, what it is it takes place. It opens with me buying the gun, and it takes place during that waiting period, up until I have the breakthrough that makes me realize what this is all about and make sense of all of this. Not trifecta, it was four things, that hit me all at once. It helped me to sort of make sense out of them, which helped the pain some, but at least, pulled me back from the brink. I also interviewed people who dealt with mental health issues, and I tell their stories. I allow them in short monologues to tell their stories during the show as well. So the show was got raves. I was really surprised. I got the little man out of the chair and the Chronicle and everything. And the best part of it is the emails that I got and letters that I got from people who told me that they were sufferers. And they brought their one woman said she her husband never got it. Her husband, she'd been married to her husband for years, and he never understood it. Why she the sun was shining, everything was good. She's got a roof over her head. Why, you know what? Why what do you have to be depressed about? Why can't you just smile? Go on out in the sunshine. And she dragged him kicking and screaming to the show. And she said afterwards, for the first time in their marriage, he looked at her and said, "Is that what you go through? Is that what's going through your head?" Because I really emphasize that it's an illness, that it's a sickness, and you can't talk somebody out of a sickness. Ought to be you couldn't check if you had the flu, I couldn't talk you out of it. And for some reason, people think that about depression. And I was also surprised about how many people I know who suffer from it, who are on antidepressants, who I'd had no idea, no idea, and you wouldn't know unless they told you. unless they told you. They hide it very well, and people are dying because of it. You have no idea somebody's dealing with depression, and then next thing I had a dear friend of mine jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, and no idea. No, always funny, gregarious, no idea that inside he was suffering. I did the show for, as I said, I got rave reviews and it was selling out, but I couldn't do it for a long period of time because as an actor, in this, there are scenes when I am in that place. There are scenes when I'm depressed and I'm in that place that I was back in 2000. It was 2008 when the waiting period took place. And it started to suck me back in because as an actor, I have to go there. I have to make my mindset the same as it was during that time, because if it's not real for me, it's not going to be real for the audience. So I had to stop. I couldn't do it. So flash forward to 2014, and Robin Williams, who I knew, I didn't know him very well, but I knew him. But he was, an icon here in the comedy community with us, and especially meant a lot to the world, but especially meant a lot to us comics. Committed suicide, and we were all reeling. And my publicist at the time was telling me how he had represented Rock Hudson. He was Rock Hudson's publicist at the time that Rock Hudson told the world that he was suffering from AIDS. And prior to that, AIDS, was stigmatized. It was always something that happened to those people, and it wasn't looked at as a serious health crisis that it can affect anyone. And then somebody we knew Rock Hudson. He'd been in our homes with McMillan and wife. We'd seen him on the big screen. He was somebody we knew. It changed. This publicist tells me it changed the whole conversation. So maybe Robin's suicide might change the conversation about suicidal ideation and about depression. So I thought, you know what? I should bring the waiting period back then, but why don't I do it for free? Do it for free to the public so that cost is not a barrier. And we have a real high there's a real high number of kids in college, in high school, but especially in college, who commit suicide. And who couldn't afford $30 or $40 for a theater ticket? So if I can do it for free, there's no barrier, and they can come and see it. And so I was. This is 2015. We started a GoFundMe to pay for all of the expenses, the theater expenses, and the engineer and lighting people and all that stuff. And I started doing it, and I got so many letters and stories from people who literally had their lives saved by that play, that I decided to keep doing this. So every year we do a GoFundMe to pay for it, and we get some wonderful sponsors, the Handlery Hotel in San Francisco, and Fremont Bank, and a number of banks and businesses have supported this. And it really does save lives. So now I've been doing this for 10 years. I do it a couple of times a month at usually a Sunday afternoon, either at the Marsh in Berkeley or the Marsh in San Francisco. I mean, amazing stories, Kat. I'll tell you a quick one. This is the one that makes that I always tell people about. This is why I do this. I got a letter from a woman who told me that she was going to commit suicide. She had planned to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge, and she had it all planned out how she was going to do it. She dressed in the outfit she wanted to wear and be found in. She went to The plan was to go to her favorite cafe and have a pastry and her favorite coffee drink, just one last thing, then drive to the bridge and jump. So she does this, and it's a Sunday, and she's at the cafe, and she gets her pastry, she gets her coffee drink, and then she sits down on one of the tables, and the Chronicle Pink section is on the table, just happens to be there. And it's open to a page where there's a picture of me and just a little blurb about the waiting period, what the waiting period's about, and that it's free. So she thinks about whether or not she should go and see it instead of going to the bridge, or do it before she goes to the bridge. And she decides to flip a coin. Heads, she goes to the bridge and she jumps. Tails, she comes and sees the show. So she flips a coin, the coin comes up tails, and she comes to the show. And she said she sat there and she cried because I expressed a lot of what she was feeling, and she didn't think that anybody else could ever possibly understand. Again, you're not in your right mind when you are depressed like that, and you don't think anybody will get it, and you don't think anybody will understand. And she said that when the show was over, she sat in her seat for like 20 minutes and cried after it was over. And she called her sister and told her sister what she'd been planning. And her sister came and got her some help. And as far as I know, she's with us today. And that's why I do this. And that's why I put myself through this. And that's how I put it. Because as I said, I gotta go. I gotta live this. Every time I do this
Yeah.
show, I have to live this.
Brian Copeland, the tyranny of the clock. I could talk to you forever, but I gotta wrap it up. I know that this is an ongoing performance, but tell folks where they can see it next, and also tell folks where they can follow you so they can keep track of when you were doing your shows and where.
Okay, so the first thing is to follow me, go to briancopeland.com, briancopeland.com, and everything's there about all my appearances, my books, book signings, book events, everything is there. briancopeland.com, as well as my podcast, Copeland's Corner, which you can get wherever you get your podcasts, or you can watch us do it on YouTube, drops every Thursday. That's the first thing. In terms of seeing the waiting period, here are the next couple of dates, and more dates are going to be added. But the next few, August 10th and August 24th at the Marsh. And I think those are 12 o'clock. It's like a Sunday's at 12 o'clock. I think that's what these two are. But you'll need to check. You can go to my website or you can go to the Marsh website, which is the Marsh, MARSH, themarsh.org. September 20th is a special performance. That will be the 500th performance of that show on September the 20th. Again, this is free. So if you are somebody who suffers from depression, or if you have a family member who deals with depression or mental health issues, come. The show's an hour. It's short. It's an hour, but it's a very, very powerful hour, and it does help. It really does help. So I don't just invite you, I implore you to come and check it out.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.